force devoid of any female guidance, and so she is its figurehead, the respectable face of Fabianism. For her part, Bianca has not been let in on Fabian's secret, but she remembers their miraculous escape from Great Nest and knows his reputation as a chemical architect. She has yoked her future to his, and now must hope that he is as good as he thinks he is. The old weapons that allowed their species to fully dominate the ants, and thereby vastly enrich and complicate their society, are no longer viable weapons of war. The deconditioning effect of the porcid beetle master scent is something that most ants are now conditioned to resist, both because of inter-spider rivalries and simply because the porcid beetles themselves are constantly hacking colony architecture for their own purposes, remaining a persistent ghost in the organic machine. The spiders can only strive to minimise their effects. Fabian's plan is more complex, therefore more risky. The first phase is a frontal assault. The path that the Great Nest Column is likely to take has already been densely strewn with a complex maze of deadfalls, spring traps, webs and fire traps. No spider would be fooled by them, but ant senses are easier to deceive, especially as they have little ability to sense anything at a distance. The Great Nest force is screened by a large dispersed cloud of scouts to find and trigger these traps, and it is onto these that Fabian sets his own troops. The response is immediate. Alarm scents drawing more and more of the invaders. Positioned upwind of the skirmish, Fabian releases scent after scent into the air. Each one contains a fresh set of instructions, chemically encoded, allowing his small force to react swiftly, to change tactics and outmaneuver the enemy, whilst the Great Nest ants are simply following a basic battle architecture, little changed from the insect's ancient fighting instincts. Within minutes, Fabian's forces have pulled out with minimal losses, and with prisoners, a handful of scouts cut off, immobilised and carried away. Fabian and his fellows retreat, and keep retreating until the pursuing scouts from Great Nest break off and follow their own scent trails back to the advancing column. Left in peace, Fabian's team set up their laboratory and use samples from the captured scouts to brew up a fresh set of instructions for their soldiers. Their ants are given their initial orders. Their little force splits up, each ant to its own, and heads for the enemy. "What are you doing?" Bianca demands. "You have thrown away your army." Everyone knows that ants are only effective in force. A lone ant counts for nothing. "We must move," is all Fabian will say. "We must be upwind of them." It is an annoying limitation of his technique, but one he will solve in time. He is already working out systems in his head, using porcid beetles as carriers of new information, or somehow triggering chemical releases by distant visual cues. But for now, he must work with what he has. The host of individual ants reach the enemy column and pass through the far-flung screen of scouts without any alarm being raised. They touch antennae with the invaders, a quick fidget of appendages, and are let through, recognised as friends. From a viewpoint in the branches, Fabian tensely watches his ants accumulating unnoticed within the Great Nest ranks. Now comes the hardest step for Fabian himself. He has never been responsible for the death of another of his species. He knows that there are those who live lives of deprivation, where to fight, kill, and even consume another spider is simple survival. But he feels strongly that he is working directly against such deprivation, and that to kill one's own belongs in the past. The nanovirus in him resists the necessity of what he intends, recognising the sibling strains in his potential victims. His plan is delicately balanced, however, and he cannot let anything endanger it. There are a dozen or so observers from Great Nest moving amidst the thousand-strong column. Surely they will notice the foreign ants amongst their ranks. Although the Great Nest Army will already have its rigid architecture in place, there will be a series of preset protocols that the spider officers will trigger, no doubt including one to order the attack on Seven Trees itself. It is possible that one of these pre-prepared positions will be some manner of emergency response. Fabian releases his next set of instructions with some foreboding. his infiltrators systematically seek out and murder the great nest spiders accompanying the army. They attack fearlessly, releasing alarm scents that throw the nearby loyalist ants into a frenzy. It is a calculated, merciless act painstakingly planned out in advance. Watching the result, which leaves knots of ants grappling over loose limbs and scraps of carapace, Fabian's people and Bianca are quiet and subdued. Of course, it is not the first time that spider has killed spider, or even that male has killed female, but this is different. It represents a gateway to a new war. From there on, the Great Nest Column is doomed. Fabian's soldiers eat it from the inside out. The invading army has some defences, preset conditioning to defend itself against unexpected attack, plus shifting scent codes that change in a prearranged sequence over time. But Fabian's new architecture allows him to shift, swiftly to adapt. The lumbering composite engine that is the Great Nest Army has detected that something is going wrong, but it simply cannot adjust quickly enough to understand the threat. A trail of dead ants stretches for kilometres by the time Fabian is through. His own losses are less than a dozen. His Thermopylae has not been a physical, but a mental constriction that the enemy simply could not pass through while he held it against them. Great Nest is not defeated yet. The column Fabian has destroyed is merely a fraction of the military machine that the temple there can set in motion. Seven Trees' victory will be answered by further aggression, no doubt. Fabian returns home and presents himself to the ruling females. They demand to know his secret. He will not tell them, and he confirms that he and all of his peer group have taken precautions to ensure that their new understandings cannot be extracted by force from their dead bodies. One of the females, call her Viola, takes the lead.
"So what will you do?"
Fabian suspects that she has thought further ahead than her sisters, having used his services before the war came. She has some idea how he thinks.
"I will defeat Great Nest and its allies," he declares. "If necessary, I will take an army from Seven Trees all the way to their city and show them the error of their ways."
The reactions he sees are a fascinating mix. Horror that a male can speak so boldly of such large matters. Ambition to see their stronger rival humbled. Desperation, because what option do they have? Viola prompts him to go on. She knows there is more.
"I have a condition," he admits. Before that massed and hostile gaze, he outlines for them what he wants, what he wishes them to commit Seven Trees to, in return for its survival. It is the same deal he put before Portia. They are scarcely more inclined towards it, but then Portia was not in their current precarious position.
"I want the right to live," he tells them, as firmly as he dares. "I want the death of a male to be punishable, just as the death of a female is. Even a death after mating. I want the right to build my own peer house, and to speak for it."
A million-year prejudice stares back at him. The ancient cannibal spider, whose old instincts still form the shell within which their culture is nestled, recoils in horror. He sees the conflict within them, tradition against progress, the known past against the unknown future. They have come so far as a species. They have the intellect to break from the shackles of yesterday. But it will be hard. He turns slowly on the spot, in a series of short, jerky moves, looking from eye to eye to eye. They weigh him up, and they weigh the cost of his demands against the cost of having to acquiesce to Great Nest. They consider what his victory has bought them, and how it has improved their bargaining position. They ponder what Great Nest will exact from them if they surrender. Certainly the temple at Seven Trees will be emptied and filled with foreign priestesses, all enforcing their orthodox vision of the messenger's will. Control of Seven Trees will be removed from these females here. Their city will become a puppet worked by strings from afar, dancing to the pulse of Great Nest's radioed instructions. They confer, they agonize, they threaten each other, and scuffle for dominance. At last, they formulate their answer.
Chapter 5.7 Ascension.
It wasn't meant to happen like this. It wasn't meant to take so much time.
Halston was dining with Guyon. The commander's cultists, or highly trained engineers, or whatever they really were, had brought him some of the rations that he remembered being pillaged wholesale from the terraforming station. It was heated and thawed to a warm slurry, and he spooned this slop unenthusiastically into his mouth as the old man talked. What Guyon ate these days was unclear, but he probably had a tube for that, and another one at the other end to deal with what his desiccated insides couldn't process.
"I woke up a crew that looked good, according to the records. They all had tech experience,"
Guyon went on, or at least the machines that spoke for him did.
"We had all the kit we'd taken from the station. Preparing the ship was supposed to be quick. Just another few days. Just another few months. Just another year. Always just another year. And then I'd go to sleep for a bit, and wake up, and they'd still be at work."
His withered face went slack with remembering.
"And you know what? One day I woke up, and all those young faces, I realized that half the people doing the work had been born outside suspension. I'd taken up people's whole lives, Mason. They'd been trying to make it work for that long. And the new generation, they didn't know as much. They had learned what they could, but... And then came another generation, devolving, understanding less than before. Everyone was too busy doing the work to pass on the knowledge. They knew nothing but the ship, and me. I had to lead them because they had work to do, no matter how inferior they were, how much longer it would take. Because you need to fight the Curran satellite, the Bryn habitat thing," Halston filled in for him, between mouthfuls. "I have to save the species," Guyon confirmed, as though that meant the same thing. "And we did it. We did it, all of us. All those lives weren't wasted after all. We have Empire tech defences, physical and electronic. There's not a weak point left where Curran can sneak in and switch us all off. But by then I realised that I was old, and I realised how much the ship needed me, and so we got the upload facility and started work on that. I've given everything, Mason. I've given so many years to the Gilgamesh project. I really want to just close my eyes and let go."
The artificial voice fell to a static whisper. Halston recognised this as a sacrosanct pause, and he didn't try to insert any words.
"If I thought there was no need of me," Guyon murmured, "if I thought you could manage without my guidance, then I would go. I don't want to be here. Who would want to be this dying, intubated thing? But there's nobody else. The human race stands on my shoulders, Mason. I am the shepherd. Only through me will our people find their true home."
Mason nodded and nodded, and thought that Guyon might or might not believe all of that, but knew that he detected a thread of mendacity nonetheless. Guyon had never been a man to take advice or to share command. Why should he now be a man who would hand it over, especially when a kind of immortality was his for the taking if this upload business worked? If the uploader didn't wreck the Gilgamesh's systems.
"Why not Lane?" he asked Guyon.
The old man twitched at the name.
"What about Lane?"
"She's chief engineer. You wanted all this work doing, so why not pop her out sooner? I've seen her. She's older, but not..."
"Not as much as you." "Not that much older. You can't have sprung her from the chambers that long ago. Why not start with her?"
Guyon glowered at him for a moment, or perhaps some machine glowered at him on Guyon's blind behalf.
"I don't trust Lane," he snapped. "She has ideas."
There was no real answer to that. By now, Halston had already formed distinct ideas about whether Guyon was crazy and whether Lane was sane. Unfortunately, that did not seem to translate into an equal certainty about which of them was right. He had one arrow left in the quiver. There was a sequence of recordings that Lane had played for him, before that meeting with Karsten Vitus, the last transmissions of the moon colony that they had set up back in Kern's system. It had been Lane's secret weapon, to persuade him that something must be done. It had worked at the time. She had been merciless, and Holston had been left as depressed and miserable as he ever had been. He had heard the desperate, panicking voices of the people Guyon had left behind, their pleas, their reports. Everything had been failing. The infrastructure of the colony had simply not been self-sustaining. Long decades after the base was established, it began to die. Guyon had left a community there, some awake, some in suspension. He had abandoned them to live there, and to raise their children to replace them at the helm of that doomed venture. Then the Gill's commander had listened to their dying cries, their frantic begging, enduring the cold, the foul air. The lucky ones would have just rotted in their cold coffins once the power failed. The last message had been a distress beacon, automated, repeated over and over. The successor, humanity's version, of Kern's thousand-year call. Finally, even that had ceased. Even that had not stood the test of that little span of time. "I heard the recordings from the moon base," he told Guyon. The commander's leathery visage swung towards him.
"Did you?"
"Lane played them to me."
"I'm sure she did."
Holston waited, but there was nothing more forthcoming.
"You're what? You're denying it? You're saying Lane faked it?"
Guyon shook his head, or something else shook it for him.
"What was I supposed to do?"
he demanded.
"Go back for them?"
Holston was about to say that yes, that was exactly what Guyon should have done. Instead, a little scientific awareness coloured his passion, and he began, "The time."
"We were decades away," Guyon agreed. "It would have taken decades to return to them. By the time they found there was a problem, they didn't have anywhere near that long." "You wanted me to go through the colossal exercise and waste of turning this ship around? Just to bury them?"
Guyon almost managed it then. Holston's perceptions of right and wrong flipped and flopped, and he found he could look into that grey, dying face and see the saviour of mankind, a man who had been trained to make tough decisions and had made them with regret but without hesitation. Then a real expression finally clawed its way onto Guyon's face.
"And besides," he added, "they were traitors."
Holston sat quite still, staring at the horrible rearrangement of the commander's features. A kind of childish, idiot satisfaction had gripped the old man, perhaps entirely without his knowledge. There had been mutineers, of course, as Holston had more cause than most to remember. He recalled Skulls, Nessel, and all that rhetoric about being sacrificed to an icy grave. And they were right. And, of course, most of the actual mutineers had been killed. The cargo decanted out to form the moon base crew had not been traitors. In fact, they would have had very little idea of what was going on before learning of their fate.
"Traitors," Guyon repeated, as if savouring the word. "In the end, they got what they deserved."
The transition from earnest, martyred leader to raving psychopath had simply happened without any discernible boundary being crossed. Then people started entering the chamber. Guyon's people. They shuffled about in their robes, and swirled and milled into a ragged congregation before the great mechanical majesty of Guyon's dais. Holston saw them arrive in their hundreds. Men, women, children.
"What's happening?" he demanded.
"We're ready," Guyon breathed.
"The time has come."
"Your upload? My ascension? My eternal duty? That will enable me to guide my people forever, in this world and the next."
He began to take the steps stiffly, one at a time. From somewhere, Vitus and a handful of her team had appeared, hovering about the machines like a priesthood. The science chief glanced once at Holston, but incuriously. Around the edges of the wider chamber there stood a score or so of men and women in armoured shipsuits. Kast's security team. One of them must be the man himself, but they had their visors lowered.
"So, the old gang's together again, all but one."
Holston was acutely aware that Lane would expect him to buy her some time, although he had no idea if she was even on her way.
Guyon, he called after the commander. What about them?
His gesture took in the massing congregation.
What happens to them when you're... translated? Do they just keep multiplying until they overrun the ship? Until there's nothing left to eat? What happens? I will provide for them, Guyon promised. I will show them the way. It'll be the moon colony all over again, Holston snapped. They'll die. They'll eat all the food. They'll just live everywhere until things break down. This isn't a cruise ship. The Gill isn't supposed to be lived in. They're cargo. We're all cargo.
He took a deep breath.
But you'll have your electronic avatar by then. So long as the power holds, you'll be fine. Probably most of the ship will be fine. The cargo in suspension. But these people and their children... And then what? Maybe one generation after that? They'll die. Your followers will die a drawn-out death of starvation and failing machinery and cold and suffocation. And all the other things that can happen, because we're out in fucking space!
He had shocked himself with the vehemence of his tirade, thinking, do I actually care about all these lunatics that much? But apparently he did.
I will provide!
Guyon's voice rose to a boom without effort, channeled through speakers about the room.
I am the last shepherd of the human race!
Holston had expected his own words to start a riot of fear and uncertainty among the congregation, but they seemed weirdly placid, accepting what Guyon said and barely seeming to register a word said against him. In fact, the only reaction he got was that suddenly a couple of the larger sheep in Guyon's flock were standing at his shoulders, laying hands on him as if about to bundle him away. He needed more ammunition. He would have to fight dirty now.
One more thing! He shouted, just as Guyon reached the top step. You do know that Karst and Vetus have been working with Lane behind your back?
The dead silence that followed this pronouncement was spoiled by Karst's helmet-muffled voice, spitting out,
Oh, you fucker!
Guyon had become quite still, and so everyone had become quite still. Holston stole a look at Vetus, who was observing the situation around her with a calmly inquisitive air, as if she could not feel the sudden change of mood in the crowd. Karst's people had begun to bunch up. They all had guns, and now these were mostly pointing at the faithful. Have I just done the most sensible thing that I could, under the circumstances?
I don't believe you,
Guyon's voice croaked, although if his disembodied voice was indeed devoid of belief, it was full to the brim with electronic doubt. Guyon's paranoia clearly had a 360-degree field of vision.
When your clowns grabbed me, I was just coming back from a meeting. Of me, Lane, her, him.
Pointing out the guilty for the court.
Mason, shut up or I will shoot your fucking head off.
Karst bellowed, neatly erasing any lingering suggestion of innocence. The congregation was mostly armed, even if it was with knives and makeshift spears and maces. They outnumbered Karst's squad heavily, and the quarters were close.
You will go back into suspension, Guyon snapped. You, Vetus, all of your people. Piss off. And what then? Karst snapped. You think I trust you? I will be the ship, Guyon fairly howled. I will be everything. I will have the power of life and death over every member of the human race. Do you think that simply staying out of suspension will save you from my wrath if you defy me? Obey me now, and I will be merciful.
Commander, Vetus started. Above the rising mutter of the congregation, Holston did his best to read her lips.
You too, traitor!
Guyon levelled a twig-thin finger at her. Then either Karst or one of his people, Holston didn't see which, tried to level a gun at Guyon, and the fighting started. A few shots went off, striking sparks from the ceiling, some ripping hungrily into the crowd, but matters degenerated into a brawl almost immediately. The untrained but fervent masses ranged against Karst's few. That was when Lane chose to make her move.
A knot of robed acolytes burst from the throng, bounding up the steps towards Guyon, and even Holston thought they were fanatics heading to protect their leader to form some sort of human shield. Only when their leader dragged some sort of makeshift weapon out and her cowl slipped back did he realize his mistake. Moments later, Lane had her weapon, some sort of industrial nail gun, against the side of Guyon's head and was yelling for everyone's attention. They were about 20 people down to injury or death by that point, a couple of castes banned and the rest luckless followers of the Church of Guyon. Lane never got her requested silence. There was sobbing, cries for help, at least one keening wail that spoke of desolated loss and grief. The bulk of the faithful, however, were frozen in place, seeing their prophet about to be struck down at the very point of his transcendence.
"Now!"
Lane shouted, as best she could. Her voice wasn't made for public declamation, or for confrontational heresy, but she did her utmost.
"Nobody's going anywhere! And that includes into that fucking computer. Cast!"
It was Guyon's voice, although his lips hadn't moved. Holston looked over to the security team, backed into a tight knot with their leader in its midst. If there was any reply, it was too quiet to be heard, but it was plain that there would be no help for Guyon from that quarter, not any more.
"Vetus, disconnect this shit," Lane instructed. "Then we can start to sort out the mess."
"Hmm." The science chief cocked her head on one side.
"You have some sort of plan, then, chief engineer?"
It seemed an odd thing to say for someone with no small talk. Holston saw the frown on Lane's face. And of course, Vetus had wanted the upload to go ahead. She had wanted to see what would happen.
"Lane!" Holston shouted. "It's happening! He's uploading now!"
It was a lengthy process, but of course Guyon had been plugged in all this time. He had probably been feeding his brain into the Gill's memory for ages, a bite-sized piece at a time. The realization hit Lane at the same time, and she pulled the trigger. Vetus's face was a picture in that split second, real shock gripping her at last, but at the same time a kind of prurient interest, as if even this twist would yield valuable data for her studies. Guyon's face, of course, joined the rest of his head in painting the upload facility red. There was a colossal groaning noise that echoed through the room, twisting and garbling and collapsing into static, but rebuilding itself jaggedly until at last it became a voice.
"I!"
shouted Guyon, even as his body collapsed back into its cradle of tubes and wires.
"I! I! I!"
The lights died, sprang back, flickered. Screens about the chamber suddenly sprang alive with random vomitings of colour and light, fragments of a human face, and that voice stuttering on.
"I! I! Mine! Obey! I!"
As though Guyon had been distilled down to the basic drives that had always motivated him.
"Damage report!"
Lane's team are all up on the dais now, accessing the Gill through the machinery there.
"Cast, get control, you useless fuckwit!"
Cast pointed his rifle at the ceiling and loosed a handful of shots, the roar of the gun scouring the room free of any other human noise, but unable to blot out the tortured glossolalia of the speakers. On the screens, something was trying to form itself into Guyon's face, a proof of ascension for the true believers. It failed and failed again. Incomplete and distorted. Sometimes, Holston thought, it was Kern's face instead. He lurched his way up the steps to join Lane. "What's going on?" "He's in the system, but it's another incomplete copy like his test runs, only it's more... there's more of him. I'm trying to isolate him, but he's fighting me. They're all fighting me. It's like he's seeded the fucking computer with his people, sent them ahead to clear the way. I..."
"You shall not prevent me!"
boomed the virtual Guyon, his first complete sentence.
"I, me, I am eternal, I am."
"What's..." Holston started, but Lane gestured him away. "Just shut up, will you? He's trying to get control over life support." Cast's people were clearing out Guyon's followers, who seemed a lot less exultant about the partial ascension of their leader than they had probably anticipated.
"Vetus, help, will you?"
The science chief had simply been staring at the screens, but now she appeared to come to a decision.
I agree, this has gone far enough.
As though it was simply a matter of an experiment that had outlived its time.
What can I... Lane hushed Holston then, trusting her team enough to take a moment away from the consoles.
Seriously, you've done what you could. You did what had to be done. You did well. But now, this is out of your area, old man. If you want, go help Cast, and hope we can contain Guyan the fucking virus before he does too much. There was a shudder through the substance of the ship, and the colour drained from Lane's face. Shit. Just go, Holston. Be safe. Words from one eggshell dweller to another.
Chapter 5.8 Conquering Hero. Fabian has come to the gates of Great Nest with an army. It is not his army, technically. Seven Trees is not so desperate that it would give over this force to the official command of a male. Viola, one of that city's most powerful females, is the speaker for her home, and therefore nominally in control. Fabian himself is there to put into effect her commands. He had expected this arrangement to rankle more than it has. It helps that Viola is calm, long-sighted, and intelligent. She does not try to tell him how to do his job. She gives him the broad sweep of strategy, bringing to the table an understanding of conflict and of spider nature that is far in excess of his own. He attends to the tactics, playing an army of thousands of ants like a maestro with his fluid, adaptable chemical architecture. The two of them work surprisingly well together. Another reason that he is glad not to have the final authority is that he is similarly denied the final responsibility. To get this far, Seven Trees and its allies have tallied up a butcher's bill of the enemy that leaves Fabian shaken every time he considers it. Aside from numberless dead ants, several hundred spiders have perished in the fighting, some by design, others by happenstance. Great Nest has done its best to reverse the tide by killing the Seven Trees' leaders, hampered in its belief that those leaders must necessarily be female. Fabian has thus been bypassed by assassins on several occasions, whereas Viola has lost two legs and has personally ended the lives of three attempting to kill her. It is a terrible truth they have discovered about themselves, all the participants in this conflict, that they are of a race that does not kill lightly, and yet give them a cause, and they will. And now they are at Great Nest itself, their army facing a host of ants dredged from that larger city's colonies, most of which are not even conditioned for military service, but will fight against enemy ants if they must. Ahead of them, the vast conurbation that is the spider's greatest city seems fragile, like mere tatters of silk that the wind might blow away. For most of his life, this was Fabian's home. There are hundreds of thousands of spiders currently crouching in their pier houses, beneath their canopies, against the tree trunks and branches, waiting to see what will happen next. There has been almost no evacuation, and Fabian has heard that the temple has done its best to prevent anyone leaving. Viola has sent a messenger to the pier houses of Great Nest with a list of demands. The messenger was a male, therefore Fabian does not envy his chances. When he himself complained, Viola stated darkly that if Fabian truly wished all the freedoms of a female for his gender, then his fellow males must take the same risks. Fabian can only try to imagine the debate going on in Great Nest even now. Portia and her temple priestesses must be urging resistance. Perhaps they believe that the messenger will save them, even as she once interceded for her people in the great war with the ants in ancient times. Certainly the temple radio frequencies must be crammed with prayers for deliverance. If the messenger has the power to aid her faithful, then what is she waiting for? Radio? And then Fabian is lost briefly in a dream of science, where every ant soldier could be fitted with a radio receiver, and somehow could write its own chemical architecture according to the urgings of signals sent out over that invisible web. A colony of ants that could be orchestrated, swift as thought. He trembles at the thought. What could we not do? And it nags at him, and nags at him, that he has come across such a thought before. And with a sudden jolt, he realizes that the great project of the messenger
which Portia and her fellow zealots have given their all to realize, the indirect cause of this war, could itself be just such a thing. No ants, no chemicals, but that net of copper would carry impulses just as the radio would, just as the individual ants in a colony would. And were there not switches, forks, gates of logic? It seems to him that such a design would have the virtue of speed, yet surely it could not be as versatile and complex as an ant colony working at full efficiency.
You know, Portia. Will she yield? Viola prompts him.
They have been waiting for a response for so long that the sun is now going down. Full dark was their deadline, for the ants can fight perfectly well at night.
If she's still in control, she will not.
The Seven Trees' forces will tear Great Nest open if they have to, and Fabian is very afraid that within the close, confused confines of a city, he may lose control. Scraps of his army may end up cut off from him, unable to be directed, still following their last conditioning. The death toll, amongst those whose only crime is to have made Great Nest their home, will be horrifying. Fabian would almost rather turn back. Viola has explained things patiently, though. Great Nest's influence has been cut back to the city's very boundaries, but it must still concede defeat. There are tens of other temple-dominated cities across the world. They must be taught this lesson. Fabian has already heard the outcome of other conflicts. Entire cities have been burned, by design or by simple accident, given how voracious fire is and how flammable much of spider construction can be. There have been massacres on both sides. There have been ant armies gone wild, reverting to their old ways, breeding unchecked. The radio brings in daily stories of worsening warfare. Great Nest stands as the symbol of defiance for the Crusaders, though. If Great Nest submits, then perhaps sanity might be salvaged from the chaos.
They will have to kill her themselves, Viola considers.
It is a moment before he understands to whom she is referring. Portia. He himself cannot think of Portia without a stab of guilt. She is the cause of this war, as much as any individual spider is. But Fabian knows bitterly that she has done all she has for what she considers the best of reasons. She has hazarded her entire city because she believes. And he still feels respect for her, and also that curious coiling sense affecting males, that here is a female to dance for and offer his life for. It is a shameful, backwards feeling, but it has been driving the males of his species to engage in the dangerous pursuit of continuing the species for millions of years. Fabian wishes things could be different, but he can plot no path from where he stands now to any outcome that would see him reconciled with Portia.
Prepare our vanguard, then.
Viola knows that he will already have considered the terrain, the opposing forces and the capabilities of their own troops, and formulated some custom conditioning for the initial assault, to be refined and amended as the war goes on. His revolutionary techniques have won battles against massively superior forces before. Now he will employ them against a defending force that is itself outnumbered and outclassed. He releases his sense. He has refined the technique. As well as airborne pheromones, a host of porcid beetles are lined up, pressed into service to carry his instructions across the breadth of the army. They are buying their continued survival with their usefulness, their services offered with a spark of awareness of the deal, disturbingly clever insects that they are. Then there is a bright flash from one of Viola's spotters, palps signalling a clear message. A party is on its way out of Great Nest, 20 or more strong. At their head is the male emissary Viola sent in. Fabian feels a gripping tension leech out of his limbs. Great Nest wants to talk. He does not recognize the bulk of the enemy delegation. Certainly none of the females now apparently in control are familiar. There are a handful he does recall. Portia's cronies from her peer house or from the temple. They are hobbled with silk and herded out by their erstwhile political opponents. They are being given over to the enemy. The story spills out swiftly. There has been a changing of the guard in Great Nest. There has been fighting within the city, spider against spider at the highest level. The priesthood has been broken and cast down.
Some remain in hiding, sheltered by those who still believe in the sanctity of the message. Some are believed to have fled. The balance are here as a token of goodwill. Of Portia, there is no word. Fabian imagines her alone and on the run. She is resourceful enough to survive, and now, without the infrastructure of the Great Nest Temple, she is not the threat to the world's peace she once was. No doubt Viola and the others will hunt her down, or her former fellows in Great Nest will, but he hopes that she survives. He hopes that she escapes to find some quiet living somewhere, and does something good. Terms are then negotiated, punitive but not impossible. The new clique, ruling Great Nest, treads a delicate line between defiance and acquiescence. Viola knows the game and plays along. It is only in watching the Seven Trees female throw herself into negotiations that Fabian realizes how much she, too, had wanted to avoid taking that final, unthinkable step. This is not the end of the War of Doctrine, but it is the beginning of the end. The fall and conversion of Great Nest is both the catalyst and a model for the future. Fighting continues in various parts of the world, but those who still believe that the messenger's message is all important only lose ground. This does not mean that nobody is talking to God, of course, but they no longer listen with the same single-minded purpose that Portia and her fellows did. Progress on the messenger's machine loses its original frantic fervour, although it does not grind to a halt. There will always be scientific minds willing to take up the challenge, who continue to speak in guarded, monitored terms to the messenger, and try and reduce the complex technical language into something fitting spider technology. The irony is that in now taking a layman's view of the instructions, some progress is being made that the faithful might never have achieved with their more doctrinal approach. And quite soon after Great Nest capitulates, Fabian finds himself crouched before the leading females of Seven Trees, a very similar gathering to the one he faced during the war. Viola is dominant, her war heroine status confirmed, and they all remember the deal they signed in adversity. He has been expecting this moment, when the great and good try to go back on their word. Has he allies? Perhaps. Bianca is there, one of the lowliest of the great, but great nonetheless, and as much through her connections with him as due to her own scientific achievements. The female magnates shuffle and settle, murmurs passing around the web. Viola brings them to order neatly. Of course, Seven Trees and our allies owe a great debt to your discoveries, she allows. Our own chemical architects are already considering all the other aspects of daily life that could be improved by such fine control as you can offer. I never intended my work to be used as a tool of violence, Fabian confirms calmly. And yes, the possibilities are near endless. Perhaps you will share your plans with us. They all become very still, waiting for his first wrong move. I have my own peer house, he tells them, reminding them right at the start of one of their major concessions. He feels the dislike and the unease ripple out, and then vanish back into their accomplished composure. I have my peers, who have shared in my understandings. As you say, there is so much that can be revolutionized. I've already begun. He remembers Bianca in Great Nest, calling him a dangerous little monster. They all see him that way now. More, they fear him. And perhaps this is the first time females have ever feared a male in his world. They must wonder whether, if he called, an army would come against them, slaved to his will and his new architecture. This is not his intention, however, and Fabian suspects that if he makes them too fearful of him, they will kill him and all his followers outright, whatever the loss to posterity. He must make up ground quickly. My peer house will help make our city the greatest the world has ever seen. Whilst it is true that my discovery must eventually spread to the wider world, whoever has first use of it will always remain its mother, and thus need never fear the armies of those who lack it. Much muted messaging vibrates around the edge of the web. Hard, calculating female gazes study Fabian, a mere morsel before them. He can see that most of them want to put him in his place, to take back what was previously given under duress.
Probably they would do it with the best intentions, under the long-ingrained assumption that a male simply could not be allowed responsibility for such weighty matters. Probably there are a dozen separate equivocations ongoing in the minds around him, to justify their now withholding what was promised to him. They will offer him Portia's deal. Let us feed and value and protect you. What else can you want? I would prefer that city to be seven trees, Fabian taps out, and hunches against the possible response. A twitch of Viola's palps prompts him to continue. I cannot hold you to our bargain, he says simply. I've asked more of you than the messenger herself. I have asked you to extend to me and my whole gender the freedoms that you yourselves live and breathe by. It is no small request. It will not be easily made real. Generations from now, there will still be those for whom these reforms rankle, and places where a matter of gender still determines whether one may be killed out of hand. The concepts themselves are hard to phrase, since gender is so integral to so much of their language. So Fabian must tread the long way round to explain his meaning. All I can say is this. That city which extends to me and mine these basic rights will have my service and that of my peers, and will gain all the profit that ensues. If seven trees will not, then some other city, more desperate, shall. If you should kill me here, you will find some of my peers already outside the city, carrying my understanding with them. We will go where we are made welcome. I would like you to make us welcome here. He leaves them arguing fiercely over his fate. The decision, he hears later, is close, almost as many against as for. Seven Trees nearly has its own schism there and then. Respected matriarchs resort to measuring legs against one another like juvenile brawlers. In the end, solid mercenary interest outweighs outraged traditional propriety, but only just. Fabian himself does not live to see the world he has helped create. 2 years after Great Nest's surrender, he is found dead in his laboratory, drained to a husk by parties unknown. Many believe that resentful traditionalists from Seven Trees are responsible. Others claim that temple fanatics from some defeated city had tracked him down. By that time, the war is won, though, and the spiders are not normally given to exacting vengeance for its own sake. Their nature tends towards the pragmatic and constructive, even in defeat. There are some who say that the perpetrator was Portia herself, whose name has since acquired a curious mystique, often spoken of but never seen, her final whereabouts and fate a mystery. By then, however, Fabian's new architecture cannot be put back in its box. His extensive peer house, mostly but not uniformly male, has spread well beyond Seven Trees, the understanding carefully guarded, but its advantages aggressively exported as stock in trade. A technological revolution is sweeping the globe. Already it has reached those who speak to the messenger. The application of Fabian's genius to matters of the divine is still in its infancy, but his wartime revelation, that his new architecture could in some way approximate to what God wishes them to build, is the dream of a number of other inquiring minds. And out in cold orbit is the fused thing that is Avrana Kern and the Sentry Pod, its computer system and the Eliza mask that it sporadically dons. She is desperate to communicate with her creation. She has taught her monkeys, as she thinks of them, a common language. Originally a stripped-down Imperial Sea, it has mushroomed into a dense field of unfamiliar concepts, as the monkeys have run away with it. She is aware that in opening communications with the inhabitants of the Green Planet, she has broken new ground in the long history of the human race. Having no other humans, in her view, to share it with, she finds the triumph lacking. She is also increasingly aware that the frame of reference of her new people seems very different. Although they share a language, she and they do not seem to have the commonality of concept that she would have expected. She is increasingly concerned about them. They seem further away from her than she would have anticipated from fellow primates. She is aware that direct interference from her, in the sense of shoehorning her desires directly into their nascent culture, is entirely against the dictates of the Bryn's mission, which was to gently encourage them and always let them come to her. There is no time. She has been away for far too long, aware that the sentry pod's power reserves have dwindled during her long sleep and have subsequently been drained almost to nothing by her showdowns with the Gilgamesh, its drones and its shuttles. The solar cells recharge slowly, but the energy deficit has already taken its toll, starving the auto-repair systems which have slowly accumulated a colossal and continual workload just to keep the pod's vital systems going. She is increasingly, miserably aware that she herself is now better classified as a vital system than anything truly living. There is no line where the machine leaves off and she begins. Not any more. Nothing of Avrana Kern is so viable as to be able to stand on its own. Eliza and the upload and the withered walnut that is her biological brain are inseparable. She has been trying to transmit to the monkeys her plans for an automated workshop, which she could then instruct to start building things down on the planet. She could then transfer herself, datum by datum, down into the gravity well. She could finally meet her arboreal people. Most importantly, she could communicate with them properly. She could look into their eyes and explain herself. The monkeys have made draggingly slow progress, and time is one of many things that Avrana Kern simply does not have enough of. She cannot understand it, but the technology that seems to have arisen on her planet has gone in a wildly different direction to that of Earth. They do not even seem to have invented the wheel, yet they have radios. They are slow to understand much of the task she has set them. She, in turn, cannot follow much of what they say to her. Their technical language is a closed book. And that is a shame, because she needs to prepare them. She needs to warn them. Her people are in danger. The Gilgamesh is coming back. Part 6. Zenith, Nadir. Chapter 6.1. The balloon goes up. Portia is watching art being made. She's fidgety, nervous. Not the fault of the art itself, but she has a great task in front of her, which occupies most of her mind. She never had much patience with sculpture telling at the best of times. A shame that all this is being done in her honour. Not just hers, of course. All 12 of her crew are here, being seen and being lauded. Portia is not even nominally in command of the voyage. However, hers is the task of greatest risk. Hers is the name being drummed about the Great Nest District of Seven Trees. She tries to shrug off her nerves and concentrate solely on the performance. 3 nimble male artists are telling the story of the martyr Fabian, the great scientist and enfranchiser. Starting with just a few support lines, they have spun themselves a 3-dimensional narrative, their threads crossing and knotting and intersecting in a constantly evolving kinetic sculpture of silk that suggests scenes from the famous pioneer's life and finally death. Each scene is built on the bones of the last, so that the ephemeral and delicate sculpture they create grows and branches, a constantly evolving visual narrative. Portia is ashamed to find she is bored. She does not have that poetic turn of mind to properly appreciate this art form. The allusions and memes required to follow the story are not found in her understandings. She is a pragmatic creature of simple, visceral pleasures. She hunts. She wrestles. She climbs. She mates. Traditional pursuits and perhaps a little old-fashioned. She prefers to think of them as timeless. She could, of course, go to the city library and obtain an understanding that would immediately allow her to appreciate this art in all its glory. But what would she lose? Some less regarded ability or knowledge would be shouldered out, for her mind has finite limits on what it can retain. Like many of her kind, she has grown comfortable with what she is, and loath to change if there is no grand need for it. She stays still for as long as she can bear, politely eyeing the ever more complex structure, while feeling the appreciative stir and tremble of the audience, knowing only that it is something denied to her. At last,
She simply cannot stay any longer in that crowd under that grand tented ceiling, and creeps out as covertly as possible. This is her night, after all. Nobody is going to deny her. Outside, she finds herself in the centre of the great conurbation that is Seven Trees Scientific District. Struck by a need for greater height and clear air, she ascends limb over limb, by line and by branch, until she can see the darkness of the sky above, seeking out the pinpoint bright dots that are stars. She knows, by learning and by understanding, that they are so far away as to make any concept of the real distance meaningless. She recalls nights spent in the wilderness, though. For there is still wilderness, despite the growth of the spider communities and their attendant support structures. Once away from the constant glare of the bioluminescent city lights, the stars can seem clear and close enough to touch. Here, though, she can barely see them at all, with everything around her lit up in 100 shades of green and blue and ultraviolet. A strange thing that she, whose work places her at the very fang point of scientific advance, feels that life is outstripping her, actually leaving her behind. Within her, she has understandings that were first held by some distant hunting ancestress, whose life was constant toil, working to feed herself and her kin, fighting off ancient enemies who are now safely domesticated, or extinct, or driven to the wildest corners of the map. Portia, this Portia, can look back at the simplified, even romanticized recollections of that time that she has inherited, and yearn for a less complex life. She feels tremors from below, and sees someone climbing up towards her. It is Fabian, her Fabian, just one of countless males named after the great liberator. He is one of two males in her 12-strong crew, and her personal assistant, chosen for his quick mind and agile body. It is overwhelming, is it not? He has a knack for saying the right things, and it doesn't matter whether he means the performance below or the great lit-up tangle that is the city around them. Tomorrow, history will be made. Fabian dances for her then, because he senses that she is unhappy, and a little flattery and attention tonight will help her on the morrow. Away from the crowd, he now performs for her the ancient courtship of their kind, and is received in turn. Monogamy, monandry, rather, is not a concept the spiders have much familiarity with, but some pairs grow used to each other. Fabian dances only for her, and she rebuffs the advances of any other. As always, at the height of his performance, when he has set down his offering before her, she feels that deep-buried jab to push the matter on to a fatal consummation. But this is all part of the experience, adding zest and immediacy before swiftly being overridden by her more civilized nature. These days, such things hardly ever happen. Below them, the performance also reaches its climax. Later, the artists will take it all down, consume their swathes of webbing, and dismantle their masterpiece. Art, like so much else, is transient. Elsewhere in the city, in the hub of learning and research that is also the Great Nest Temple for the dwindling number of parishioners who still need to embrace the unknown in their lives, Bianca is at work making her last-minute preparations. She is not one of Portia's select crew, but she has had a hand in the mission as a whole. Her interest in tomorrow's departure is almost maternal, for she has been the motivating force behind so much that is about to happen. Her true intentions are not quite what others suspect. Nothing nefarious, but she has an unusual mind equipped for thinking broader thoughts and seeing further. Bianca is a born polymath, in this context meaning she is able to absorb far more understandings than the average spider. Unlike Portia, she changes her mind regularly. The core of what she considers herself to be is simply her capacity and desire to learn, not any individual facility she might briefly take within her. Currently, she is an expert radio operator, chemist, astronomer, artificer, theologian, and mathematician, her mind crammed to bursting with a complex interlacing of knowledge. Now, long past the time when her kin are all resting, she checks and rechecks her calculations, and designs troubleshooting architecture for the ant colony she has instructed to model and double-check her figures. Her newfound theology combines with the basic thoughtfulness of her nature to give her a sense of awe and reverence about the venture in hand. Hubris is not quite a concept she grasps, but she comes very close here, alone in her control centre, as she walks through the complex stages of the plan within her mind. She has a rare perspective that enables her to look back on so many generations of struggle and growth, and be able to give a shape and a texture to history, to appreciate the incremental contributions of all those Portias and Biancas, and yes, Fabians, down through the generations. Each has contributed understandings to the sum total of arachnid knowledge. Each has been a node in the expanding web of progress. Each has planned out the path one step beyond their ancestors. In a very real way, Bianca is their child, the product of their learning, daring, discovery and sacrifice. Her mind throngs with the living learning of dead ancestors. She understands, in a real and immediate way, how she stands on the backs of giants, and that her own back, too, will be strong enough to bear the weight of many generations to come. Next morning, Portia and her crew assemble at a point beyond where the last buildings of the city taper into nothing, in the midst of a great swathe of farmland, among stands of stubby, warty trees stretching to the horizon, separated by firebreaks and the well-trodden pathways of the farming ants. The weather is fine, cloudy but with only a little breeze, as predicted. This moment has already been put off twice previously, owing to inclement conditions. Portia remains tense and still. The others deal with their nervousness each in their own way. Some crouch, some run about, some tussle or talk nonsense, feet stamping out a fretting staccato. Viola, the leader, goes from each to each, with a touch, a stroke, a twitch of palps, reassuring them. Fabian is the first to see the sky nest. Even at this distance, it is absurdly huge as it floats majestically over seven trees, coasting smoothly over the great nest district like an optical illusion. The vast silvery bulk of its gas bag is currently 300 metres long, dwarfing the long, slender cabin suspended beneath. Later, they will extend the envelope to twice its current size until the lift-to-weight ratio reaches the extreme proportions that their project will require. The spiders have been using silk for gliding since before the earliest understanding, and their increasing intelligence has led to multiple refinements of this art. Their chemical synthesis, meanwhile, gives them access to as much hydrogen as they need. With a technology of silk and lightweight wood, even their experiments with powered heavier-than-air flight result in something feather-light and buoyant. Constructing dirigibles is something that they have taken to readily. Lines are dropped by the skeleton flight crew, unravelling 100 metres to reach the ground. Glad to be in motion at last, Portia and the others scramble up, a climb barely worth mentioning. There is a brief ceremonial handover from the flight leader to Viola, and then the flight crew abseil down their own lines and leave the sky nest to its new occupants. The airship is a triumph of engineering, rugged enough to withstand the turbulent weather of the lower air, and yet, with the gas bag fully extended and filled, capable of ascending to previously inaccessible heights. The aerodynamic profile of the entire vessel is fluid and determined moment to moment by the tensioned cords of its internal structure. Now it is lifting into a stiffening breeze, its structure shifting in automatic response as the new crew settles in. Their target height is so far above their world that it barely qualifies as height at all. And even then there will be a greater journey for the most adventurous of them, for Portia. Viola checks that her crew members are in place, and then joins Portia at the forward edge of the cylindrical crew compartment, gazing out through the faintest shimmer at the receding ground below. Already the gas bag is expanding further, bloating out with more hydrogen, its leading edge reshaping itself for streamlining as the sky nest lifts away faster and faster. Here in the bows is the radio, and also the main terminal for the airship's brain. Viola places her palps into paired pits in the lectern before her, and the Sky Nest tells her how it feels, how all its component pieces are holding up. It is almost like speaking on the radio, almost like talking to a living thing. She spoke to the messenger once, did Viola, and communicating with the Sky Nest feels much like that. Tiny antennae brush and twitch the sensitive hairs of her palps, feeding her information by touch and by scent. Two of her crew stand ready to give chemical commands to the terminal here, which will swiftly spread across the ship. The ongoing calculations required to take an object of gossamer and hydrogen to the upper reaches of the atmosphere would challenge even the polymath Bianca, who therefore designed the ship to think for itself. A patient, dedicated intelligence, subordinate to the commands of its spider crew. The airship is crawling with ants. This particular species is small, 2 centimetres at most for the workers, but bred to be receptive to complex conditioning. In fact, the colony writes much of its own conditioning, its standing chemical architecture allowing it to receive direct information about the ship's situation and constantly respond to it without the intervention of the crew. Although the ants can go everywhere, their physical pace would be too slow to coordinate the vast ship's constant metamorphoses. Spider bioengineering sidesteps this problem with cultured tissue. Just as, for generations, artificial muscle has been used as a motive source for their monorail capsules and other brute force devices, so Bianca has pioneered artificial neural networks that link to chemical factories. Hence, the ants in the crew capsule do not need to walk to the other widely spaced elements of their colony. Instead, they send impulses through the ship's nerves, and these are translated to chemical instructions at the other termini. The neural network, unliving and living all at once, is a part of the colony, as if it was some bizarrely over-specialized caste. The ants are even capable of altering its complex structure, severing links and encouraging the growth of others. Bianca is probably the only spider to wonder if the thing she has created, or bred perhaps, may one day cross some nebulous line that separates the calculating but unaware from what she herself would understand as true intellect. The prospect, which will probably alarm her peers when they consider it, has been working on her mind for some time now. In fact, her current private project has a great deal to do with some of her more speculative thoughts in that direction. Aboard the Sky Nest, the crew are preparing for the conditions of the upper atmosphere. The capsule is double-hulled, a layer of air between the sheets of silk, providing the insulation they will need in the thinner reaches of the atmosphere. The outer skin of capsule and balloon is woven with silvery, glittering thread, an organic material that disperses and reflects the sunlight. The Sky Nest carries them on up towards the light dusting of clouds. Two of the crew don suits of light silk to pass through the airlock and check on the operation of the God engines, so-called because they're a development of an idea apparently received direct from the messenger. Before it was dictated as part of the old divine mandate, nobody had considered the idea of rotary motion. Now, bioelectric fields spin light metal propellers that steadily separate the Sky Nest from the ground. Some of the crew gather at the shimmering windows, crowding for a view of the city as it shrinks from a vast swathe of layered civilization to an untidy scrawl like a child's knotted picture. The mood is high and excitable. Portia is the only one there who does not share it. She remains serious, inward-looking, trying to prepare herself for her own task. She seeks solace away from the others, and carefully knots and picks her way through a mantra that has travelled alongside her people for centuries. The ancient, reassuring mathematics of the first message. It is not that she is some atavistic true believer, but that tradition comforts and calms her, as it did her distant ancestors. In the forecabin space, Viola gestures to her radio operator, and they signal that all's well. Down in Great Nest District, Bianca will receive their message and then send a communication of her own, not to the Sky Nest, but further still. Bianca is hailing God with a simple announcement. We are coming. Chapter 6.2 An Old Man in a Harsh Season. He woke to the smell of burning. For a moment, lying there with the faint reek of overstressed electrics infiltrating his nostrils, he began thinking quite calmly, cold suspension, hot smell, cold suspension, hot smell, funny. Then he realized it wasn't funny at all. It was the opposite of funny. And once again, here he was in his coffin, only the burial had now become a cremation, and he'd come back to life at just the wrong moment. He opened his mouth to cry out, and instead choked helplessly on the acrid fumes that were filling his tiny allotment of world. Then the lid came off, with a shriek of tortured metal and snapping plastic, even as he pressed against it. It was as though he had briefly been given superhuman strength. Holston yelled. No words, not even a sound that had any particular emotion behind it.